Welcome to the Nerd Party.
I'm Darren Moser.
I'm Philip Gilfus.
I'm Daniel Prue.
And this is City Alpha 3.
Welcome to City Alpha 3, the Nerd Party's dedicated Star Trek podcast. I'm Philip Gilfus. I'm joined, as usual, by my two co-hosts who may or may not be evolving to a higher form. Daniel and Darren, how are you doing?
You just disrespect our ways, Philip, and I just won't stand for it, but I guess we'll see what happens.
I know, I am waiting to see that sort of graphic where it's, you know, you just see the back of Daniel's head and it says, Daniel totally uses Spock rant.
You know, here's the thing. This episode loves to use the term evolve, but they do it in the same way the X-Men does, and it makes a lot of sense if you think of it in that context, because Saru, although it's lame, gets a new superpower in this episode. So it, right.
Are you
really
saying he's Professor X?
No, he doesn't get a cool Professor X-like power. He gets that I can shoot things out of the back of my neck power, which are totally useless and don't help
anyone.
They
should totally pass a law about this.
No, they're not useless. They're only useless because of force fields. But if someone didn't know about it, that's an awesome, like, oh, don't worry, sir. We've taken away their phasers. And Drew's just like, uh-huh, yes, I'm totally.
I'm looking forward to next episode where they're just casually walking down the corridor and you just see spikes randomly along the wall as you're walking.
He's like, sorry, Bowman, I sneezed.
He's still learning.
The scene where, unlike Linus in the turbo lift, when Saru sneezes, it's really just a bad time because everybody.
Luckily, he's really tall, so it doesn't really hurt anyone.
You've seen any cartoon with a porcupine, you know where we're going with this because it's pretty much, yes.
Well, as folks can tell, we're going to be talking about the Star Trek Discovery Season Dose episode, The Sounds of Thunder. And to help us talk about all the wonderful worlds about Saru's evolution, we have with us Sue. Sue, welcome to our lonely trio.
Why, thank you.
Now, you were super excited to talk about Saru.
I love Saru.
And I assume that this was actually before the even episode aired, so I have to go ahead and just ask you, why are you super excited about Saru?
I really have kind of loved Saru since his debut on the show. I feel that to this point, Saru has been the closest analogy I have in Star Trek to the kind of anxiety that I deal with on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So there was a connection there right from the start. And then it grew even more for me with his short trek with the Brightest Star, because we get a lot of his background. And I saw, like, I'm a pastor's kid, I'm a PK, and so is Saru. But which seems silly, but you see him in that short having these difficult conversations where he's sort of being brushed aside while his parents or his father recites to him what the faith tells them to believe, with no regard for Saru's actual situation or emotion or whatever. And all of that just resonated so deeply with me. And every time we learn something new about him, there's just more to it. I don't know how they did it, but I'm 100% invested in Saru at this point.
All in. Now, did Darren and Dale, did you rewatch the short trek? Because I did before watching this episode.
I mean, if you're asking Darren, I think you should ask him if he's watched the
short
trek.
I watched it for the first time. Yes. No. And I rewatched all the short treks right when I re-got my Discovery subscription. Because that's really what it is,
a Discovery subscription.
Yes. But no, and I, you know, I mean, we were all kind of poking at the short treks, you know, when they first came out, of like, okay, this one is good, this one's kind of eh. But if they're going to use them like this as kind of just extra bits of backstory for future episodes, like, that's great. And hey, if we're going to have Calypso interact with something in the future, I'm all for that. So
I was reading, oh goodness, and I met her briefly.
Is this a brick with words reading?
And I don't know if you know her, Sue, because of course I'm blanking on her name, Den of Geek. She does the Star Trek articles over there. But anyway, she was on the Trek panel at Galley 1. I can't remember her name. I apologize. But anyway, because I just read her episode review to get ready for this. And she actually was, not to skip to the end, but just she had some speculation about, how Calypso could fit into the time travel aspect. So I just thought that was a little
Yeah, they both deal with time travel, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, well, let's just jump into it. We've kind of talked about it already, but just before getting into the full episode, just sort of the beginning part, and Sue, you talked about this, so maybe I'll just let you run with this ball. Saru's changes. We sort of jumped over it previous episode, but, two episodes ago, Ganglia gone, and now he's sort of trying to adjust, at least in the first half of this episode. What do you think of the changes he was going through and how it was handled? Or perhaps not handled, depending upon your point of view.
This is the part I'm a little bit concerned about. I'm not super thrilled that his ganglia have fallen off and now he's not afraid ever anymore, because that's not how life works. But
he's just parachuting out of airplanes. Right.
But I do think it's interesting that we're seeing him react differently, that he's sort of aggressive and confrontational on the bridge, and he has these new emotions and these new impulses that now he's going to have to learn to control those, right? Because you can't just act this way towards your captain. You got to get that under control. So I think it's an interesting tack to take. They've certainly not, quote, fixed him, which was my biggest concern. They may have just given him some new things to deal with, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, are you glad that Saru did not do any Mr. Tricorder jokes?
I'm thinking about that scene now, which kind of a little bit falls flat for me. With
are you talking about the bridge scene?
The bridge scene between Pike and Saru, and the music is swelling and it's cutting to all these different reaction shots, and it's like, I get that Saru feels impassioned, but I don't think this is going to turn violent. It doesn't seem like this is going to, because that's kind of how they're playing it. It's this giant.
The comm officer
thing.
In the back's got his iPhone out, filming it. Guys, this is gorgeous. Dude, you won't believe what happened on Alpha Shift today, man. Saru, it was really assertive. I thought he was going to hit the captain. I was
Who
ready.
I still don't know all the names. Who is the young Asian guy? I can't remember. But anyway, when he stood up, I was standing up too, oh, there's actually no reason for me to stand up during this argument. Because, what was he going to be, going to do? Oh, there's an argument between the first officer and captain. I'm a con. Never mind. Sorry.
The weirdest part was definitely when he stood up. What?
Yeah. Well, and compare that scene.
Now we're all standing up. Yeah. We all look like idiots.
Well, compare this scene to the scene where Burnham's leading him out to die, and they're all standing, sending him off almost. And now it's so Saru's back, and he's got Saru-itude, some Saru attitude.
Oh, God. That is some 90s thing that we're now going to have as the episode title.
It's what the cool kids are calling it.
Is that the Star Trek Discovery Capri Sun flavor?
Saru-itude.
Yeah. Saru-itude.
It's comes in ecto green and.
Ooh, we are crossing the streams now. Nice. All right.
You probably want to stay away from the Mycelia network.
It's Command Radical Red and. wait, sorry, no, that's gold.
Yeah, that's actually gold or silver. I don't understand any of it. All right.
Look, the chemicals we put into it to make it match those colors is totally safe, Philip. Totally safe.
And I know this is a Saru episode, so it is kind of awkward to do a non-Saru moment, but just kind of. Since we're slightly chronological here, because in the sick bay we had Culbertz,
who spent all his time in the mycelial gym.
Oh man, he came out with 20,000 more muscles than he went in with. He traded all of his beard for muscles. It was incredible.
So, should I assume that none of you follow Wilson Cruz on Instagram?
Not on Instagram.
No, I'm not
doing.
Because it's basically constant photographs of him without his shirt on.
Hold on, let me give it to you. Hold on. Well, my note that I wrote down was that apparently the beard is so powerful that Stamets can no longer read facial expressions on him without a beard. And so when he's like, hey, aren't you excited? And Culbert's crying because he's so traumatized. And Sam's like, you look good, let's go.
But
in a lot of ways, this is really real. Right? Stamets is just so overwhelmingly happy to have his husband back, and Culber is super traumatized. He's not sure he's himself. You know, that was some excellent Wilson Cruz acting. Just facial expressions when he's realizing he doesn't have the scar.
In Starfleet, because we need one here. Yeah.
Not for another couple of 70 years. You know?
Yeah,
but I like what you said, Sue. It's true. Like it was a very real moment, mm-hmm. and you know, Discovery's had a lot of those, which is nice. I mean, when Y slipped into the Mirror Universe last week, I was exactly empathizing with it. No, I'm just kidding. But no, it is true. It is nice when we get those moments.
The problem that I have is that we get these two scenes and then it's just forgotten about. Like we never circle back around to Stamets and nothing.
Well, it's called the B plot, Daniel. But
that was like a D plot.
But even B plots and C plots have some sort of resolution. Not that I'm
not
looking
in this
for
episode.
That,
yeah. Not in this episode.
I don't expect them to like fix the problem, but normally they would at least foreshadow it. Like maybe have a final scene where like, they with them in their quarters and you know they're brushing their teeth like they did in that one episode, and then like maybe
that would have been sweet, yeah, at the end, because
and then they step away and the mirror is still them and then everybody freaks out. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, I could just see that, you know, because that's Stamets, or what was it, I forget which one said that was their favorite time, maybe they both said that at some point, but anyway, you could see like Stamets kind of like, I'm all happy brushing, then you just see like Culber sort of like zombie brushing and like, this isn't good.
It just feels like the writers forgot about...
Or he's violently hurting his teeth because now he's so muscled that he's sort of just super brushing.
His teeth just are falling. It's just that the episode forgets that this is a there's no point to it. These two scenes just happen and that's it. Like, there just feels... It felt weird to me that nothing else became of this. That there wasn't leading anywhere or nothing significant happened out of it. I just... You know, character stuff for characters. I love that sort of stuff, but it just left it up in the air. Like, okay, I guess he's just not having a great time right now.
We brought him back. Are you happy? Get off our junk, okay? Anyway,
but I think it's obviously they're gonna deal with it in later episodes. I mean, but you know, it is a good point though, Daniel.
I actually give them credit that they didn't make it easy.
Right.
You know,
he's not like, let me just put on my smock again and I'm gonna treat you, Saru, because I'm a doctor again now.
Right. It's not all hunky dory. He's not feeling right. It's not easy. And I think that's one of the things we've seen with Discovery over the two seasons, really. That things aren't as easy as Star Trek has showed us previously. But they unfortunately do make it seem easy because Tilly is back to normal. You can't tell me what she went through last week was not traumatic, but, you know, she's A-okay. No problem.
Well, but she's got her slice of galaxy pie that she's enjoying. and
Yeah, I mean, but they're still working through the Zindi network. Oh, no, wait, that's not what that was.
No, like, that's such a good point.
They're working through the sphere.
Because last episode literally ended with just Tilly crying.
Yeah.
And now there's no mention or any sort of, there's nothing there. There's no implication of any of that.
And it is interesting how, you know, Dr. Culbert is showing more fear, but Saru is not. I mean, you almost had a shift there because Dr. Culbert was a very strong character in the beginning. And I'm not saying there's a direct connection, but they are kind of showing here's a fear side on this one character, and now you're seeing Saru, you know, take action command Saru.
Karate chop Saru.
Yeah, karate action Saru, huh?
Oh man, that would be a long karate chop.
Oh man, can we get a Saru action figure where like you could take the threat ganglet out and put the spike in, and then
with removable fear of death.
Exactly. Yeah, now I'm just seeing like a little 90s figure, you know, like the commercials where it's like kids playing with. And he's like, take that, you know, Lorca. This is what I think of you.
I'm still going chronologically, which is probably not the best way, but I'll do it anyway. So our B plot ? Is that the eighth signal, seventh signal? I don't know. A signal comes, a new one comes on in space, and you'll never believe where it is, guys. it's the reason.
Is it Earth? Because that's probably where it's going next. Because I wouldn't be surprised.
So we are on the quest for the Red Angel, and you know, we can kind of encapsulate that whole story of, you know.
Well, so, I mean, is it obvious now that the Red Angel is directly tied to Discovery?
It's Michael.
Because to Michael. Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, in the beginning, it was kind of like, okay, you know, this is interesting. And now it's like, no, every instance is now directly attached to one or more of the members of this ship. Like, that is, I mean, not to get ahead, as we've seen, they have released other episode titles, and episode 10 happens to be called The Red Angel. So hopefully we'll get some answers in that week's episode. I'm just hoping.
To be fair, none of the crew existed during World War III. And Red Angel showed up and did that.
Didn't they, Daniel?
As far as we know.
Well, right. We just need to see Michael Berman's great, 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 great grandmother.
Mother, played by.
No! No!
It's a tradition, Daniel. You can't deny it.
Yes. So, yeah, it is interesting, as much as it is, that, you know, they're like, oh, there's a signal. We'll go there. And look, there's nothing here. I guess we should, I don't know, figure out why we're here. And it was sort of an interesting, like, I don't know. They usually tell us what to do in the script or something. So I guess we'll just start hailing people and hope something happens.
Well, and you get more of the dichotomy between Section 31 and Starfleet, where Section 31 is super, like, yeah, everything could be terrible, Captain, and it could all result in death. And then Pike's like, or it could be good things that we've done here, and it's all about how you look at it. Is it Red Angel or Red Menace?
Is Section 31 a part of this season just in order to keep Shahzad Latif and Michelle Yeoh in the cast?
I don't know.
I mean, because I don't look ahead at stuff, because I like to be a little blind about things. I don't know, because with the whole spinoff and then when this will occur and blah, blah, blah. I don't know at what point they're actually going to sort of let the spinoff happen, you know, even if it's just production behind the scenes. So, like, I get why Ash is still there, you know, because he's, you know, a member of Discovery. We got to cram him in there somewhere. He's sort of just like the Worf of the Star Trek movies. But I don't know Michelle's schedule. Like, I don't know if they plan to just keep Georgiou just continuously coming back, like, you know, the Q of Discovery, mm-hmm. or if she's sort of gone now, because that we sort of set up her and Leland's adventures throughout space-time. So, I don't know. All right, well, let's get to the big old story here. So we have Kaminar. Did I write that wrong? That was from memory. I thought that could be wrong.
Kaminar.
Kaminar. So I flipped some things over. All right, so Kaminar, Saru's outburst on the bridge, go down and save the planet, find out about the Red Angel. That's the whole thing. So,
excellent summary.
Wow, we just jumped right to the end of the episode. All right, folks, we're done.
So, yeah, that end credit scene, let's talk about, no.
Well, that's the whole mission. It's not like, let's go save the planet. It's like, no, just see if the priests know about Red Angels, and then we're out of here. So I don't know, Darren, what'd you think about, if you're Captain Pike, what do you think about handling Saru?
Saru's, yeah, he's kind of going off the rails here. I mean, he has a point, but
it's
again,
loud.
There's been a lot of talk this last season about, you know, General Order 1 and when we ignore it. Like, again, I feel if this was 24th century and this was like Picard and he's like, okay, we need to, like, I would totally see him sending Saru down. Like, I don't have a problem with sending Saru down, but they constructed this narrative around that we shouldn't be doing this, and the whole, like, oh, but the Kelpians see warp technology all the time. They just don't have it. I'm like, that's kind of flimsy as far as, like, is that going to hold up in court? I don't think so. But
space court.
Yeah, space court. But we need Philippa Jagg getting out here, making good law. Here's your chance, so make it a good one. I mean, again, they're not going to send Saru down on the mission. And actually, this reminded me a lot of, I think, is it Fear Itself? The standalone novel, which I've read all the novels for Discovery, and that one was about Saru. And it was good, and he kind of had some moments where he went off on his own reconnaissance, kind of read between the lines of what the captain's orders were and made his own decisions based on his own judgment. And we definitely see a lot of that here, because really, I mean, he's being backed up by the Discovery crew, but once he goes down, he's pretty much on his own, just him and his sister. And good thing he, like, Rambos up and is able to to take out, you know, doesn't get Tasha Yard, or because that would be bad.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just throwing out all the bombs right now and just laying
spikes.
Laying, yeah,
they're called spikes.
Sorry, spikes. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just glad the first person he met was his sister. That's
well, he did say out. He went to his village, so it's not a surprise. And
right,
we don't know how long it's
surprise
been.
To him.
That's true. Well, and how long has it been since he left? I mean, they
20 years, 18 or 20 years, they said.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said it, but I've forgotten it. 18 years, something like that.
Well, he comes upon the priest, and he's not at all surprised that it's not his dad.
Yeah.
So, like,
right, he doesn't say, "Hey, dad." He's like, "Oh, good." He could identify it as a priest, and he's
like,
"Hey."
But in that moment, because a village supposedly only has one priest, he just learned his dad's dead. But is surprised that it's his sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was. I mean, I thought it was funny. He's like, "Oh, what happened to our father?" I'm like, "Dude, he's dead. It's been too long, man." But I hate to tell you, even without your sister telling you. But anyway,
Bahari. But I didn't think it was. That's what this is all about.
Went to the old priest home. You know, that's it.
In the sky.
Went out to pastor.
Oh, nice. Welcome to City Hall 3.
Nice.
All right.
Oh, PK joke.
Exactly.
Hang on. Let's.
But anyway,
can we just talk about it just for a minute? Because.
I mean, they do, so no,
they bring it. They bring up the Prime Directive, so should we. And
I mean, General Order 1, but I know what
General
you mean.
Order 1. No, this is. I mean, I will grant them sending Saru down since he just comes from the planet. And he knows everything about it. He's totally fine. First of all, why would you ever even think about sending Michael down? Without why? I don't know. It just bothered me. That was the one thing Pike did that I'm like, Pike, what the hell, man.
Because they established that they've never seen anybody beside a Kelpian. And
so,
I mean, that was a really cool
scene,
though.
But hold on. General Order 1 / the Prime Directive is about not interfering with the culture's natural development.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? True. So Pike says, "We can bend it, let's not break it." Meaning, go have first contact, but don't do anything that's going to affect their development. And
yeah, they totally
40 minutes later,
do anything that would change the Kelpian
change
species
everything.
As a whole for life.
He literally offers to broker a peace between these two peoples. And it's like, you're kind of breaking your own rules there right now there, bud. And yeah, I don't know. It's fine. But why even bring it up if you're just not going to...
I mean, Saru's wearing his Marxist hat as he beams down. Like, you can see where this is going.
Unite,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, I did like the scene with Burnham, though. I liked where she met his sister, and it's kind of like his two sisters meeting, and the way they directed that and handled that with, you know, yeah, it's a shock seeing your brother again after 18 years, and then it's like, oh, and we're not alone in the universe, but they do reveal that she saw him beam out and the shuttle leaves, so she's kind of like, if you're gonna talk to a Kelpian on the planet, she's gonna be the one who's most understanding
and will not talk, but you know, look, they have a clear corollary to General Order 1 on Discovery, guys. As long as you beam, you can beam and show any technology in front of a church, a priest, anything related to
just pretend you're
faith,
the sky god
practices.
And it's all good. Okay.
Yeah,
so it's a religious exception, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Well, when your MacGuffin is an angel.
Oh, he's been shot. We need to pray in the church.
It'll just be like in the middle of a firefight, an alien planet, and be like, "Do you have a church? Because we need to do something right now."
These are holy relics that light up and make sound.
And I guess what y'all are talking about, I think the challenge, I'm not going to say problem, the challenge, and it works for me because I just do it in my head and I don't care, for Discovery is with the Prime Directive in General Order 1 with Star Trek, obviously very ingrained. We all the diehards know it very well. But this is TOS, and I'm very familiar with how Kirk did Prime Directive. And so that's why I'm kind of like, meh, that's what Kirk would have done. So I'm not going to jump up and down about it.
Yeah, I'm more interested in how this works, especially as a justification, because they're like, oh, the Kelpians, the Ba'ul, have faster than light travel, and the Kelpians can't make metal, or can't mine metal. So, like,
There's... Yeah, no, they can shred. They just can't.
Nice. So it's just like this disparity is incredible, and the fact that I guess I'm just speaking to the larger system that exists on this planet, supposedly.
I mean, who wants to live in the Briar Patch, Daniel?
Yeah,
apparently the Ba'ul.
But why? I don't know. They're like, oh, these people are gonna come at us with their spikes and stuff, and we have force fields. And it's like, I think your great balance is you're pretty safe for forever, probably. But mm-hmm. Anyways, I guess we haven't got to the Ba'ul yet, but
Well, let's go ahead and do it. When the
Ba'ku decided to take over this planet, it was shocked.
It turns out they were all related the whole time.
They were. Guys. Wait, never mind. It's Ba'u. It's not the Ba'ku. But I tell you, that apostrophe is really important in Star Trek. You know, it's. Yeah, the Klingons, they have a whole chapter of their book about where you put the apostrophe. So.
Yeah. And I'm going with it. This is my I'm going with it thing. That, guys, I just want that every episode now. They're just going to be like in like halfway through or three-fourths of the way, like, we don't know what to do. Oh, hey, guys, we're looking through the Sphere files. It actually has everything. We just searched and wikied it, and apparently here's the answer to everything. So it's like, that's very helpful.
That is true. It is very helpful.
We have graphics about population, and what do you want? We got it.
So are you saying
if only that information was available for the following 50 years?
I mean, are we going to take a page out of Enterprise now, and there's going to be like some religious cult around the Sphere that is upset that they have this knowledge and they're going to beam on and delete it? Like, is that how we're getting out of it?
Oh, I hope
we know it.
I would almost be surprised if that became the basis of Memory Alpha, like in universe. I would not be surprised by that.
The information is hardwired into the ship, which is why it is set adrift, never to be touched again.
Starfleet Command will decide that it's too much knowledge for us to have and highly classify it.
You can't have genealogy records back decades. That's just, I won't stand for it. That's just crazy.
We were so excited
to ask
if we
could. Don't give these people ideas, guys. Come on.
We never asked if we should.
Oh, gosh. It is plot-ish, but, you know.
I want to say two things about that. First of all, to be fair, last week we criticized them and we said, wow, that'll probably never come up again. And we thought that they would never bring it up again. And here they are using it practically. So I will give them credit to say, hey, they're at least using it in a way.
And
that
I believe
sense.
That Robolady can collate the heck out of that stuff. So yeah. We're good there.
Robolady is still awesome. And I still want more lines from Robolady. But
my wife Jessica did laugh at that line. Like, we found it. Okay.
And I forgot my other point. But yes. Oh, I was going to say, we did the same thing happened in TNG with the people, the Barkley, that we met with through Barkley.
Oh, yeah.
The nth degree.
Yeah, and we never, ever used that information for anything important. Yeah. So that's par for the course.
No. Like I said, I think it's funny. It'd just be hilarious if they just use it every episode.
Yeah.
Be like, oh, Spock, we found the problem with your Red Angel. It's actually here in this file folder marked.
Did you know that the Red Angel showed up again 3,000 years ago and then 9,000 years ago? And it's, you know, we have records here. But yeah, no, it's, I mean, I what do you guys think of Saru's planet, though? I mean, like the design, the aesthetic, the fisherman's village and the pylons. And it was a really great, I felt like I was in an alien world that was fully fleshed out.
Yeah, I complete with floating plinth. So
it's beautiful.
Yeah,
and I think they did a really good job of extrapolating what Saru would do with his quarters coming from a planet like that. I think that was really well done.
Yeah, I mean, it's because it's one of the things I didn't notice when I was rewatching the Short Treks to get ready. Then I noticed when she gave him the knife in the Short Treks. I'm like, that's where he had the knife for the previous episode of when, you know, he asked Michael to use the knife to cut off his thing. So, yeah. Yeah, and it was interesting. We talked about, you know, not using Saru seems silly, but, I mean, Saru had an agenda. So, I mean, I see Pike, you know, the mission is find out about the Red Angel intelligence gathering. It's not completely overturn the culture of this world. But
to Saru, that's really his mission. Like, I mean, and he literally tells him, like, don't do that. And it's like, yeah, but... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the actual plot of the episode, is Saru going to learn the wrong lesson from this? Because he disobeyed direct orders. He did things totally against the book.
And the Red Angel bailed him out.
And the Red Angel bailed him out. Now he gets to do whatever the hell he wants. I don't know. I hope he doesn't. I don't think he will.
That's true. If the Red Angel didn't show up again, literally he'd be responsible for the genocide of his entire species.
Yeah.
Which would explain why there's no Kelpians in Next Gen. Is canon really that important to you guys?
Are we now calling this the Red Angel universe? Is that what happens?
Oh, God.
Is this now
a
different timeline?
The Angelverse? No.
I saw an off-the-wall theory the other day that was saying it's not Red Angel, it's Red Matter. It's actually Spock Prime trying to fix things that would destroy the Kelvin timeline. And I'm like, but you know Leonard Nimoy's not around anymore. I don't think they would do that. Yeah, and that was a weaker of the plot ideas.
Yeah,
but.
I mean, as much as you make fun of the writers, everything's shot. I know what they know is going to happen, but I would like to think there for a moment that it's just like Lost and like, no, we totally know who the Red Angel is. Who do you think it is? Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's steal that one. Yeah.
That's true. Okay, guys, we drew a line in the sand. We said episode 10 is called the Red Angel. We have until then to figure out who the Red Angel is.
But we never explained the red polar bear.
Maybe Robo Lady's the Red Angel, and then I'll be really excited.
Oh, goodness. So what do we think of the Bowel? We talked a little bit, because I know Daniel and Darren, you were both excited. Like, early on, season one, when Saru is introduced, and we got this whole Predator-Prey.
Anytime we're in the transporter room redress, I get excited, because, no, I'm just kidding. It took me out of it a little bit. I mean, it was good. I liked that set, but it was really, in like half a second, I'm like, we're back in the transporter room. Like, because it's so distinctive with like the platform and the stairs leading up to it. And I'm like, this is where we are.
Well, but it's like a hexagon. Like, it's like most rooms are not shaped like this, man. Like, they don't have.
And they literally just beam down. We had a couple scenes and then we're on the ship. And I'm like, well, now we're here. Like,
they turn the lights back on.
Yeah, they turn the lights back on. I think they even had red lighting on the stairs. And I'm like, that's just what they do on the transport. It says, don't step here because we're beaming people in the sphere. So don't do that. But
did they use the same room for Fantastic Beast in the first one, where they have sort of the death execution room with the black goo? Because it's like the same thing, basically.
That's true. That was a little more kind of like a 12 Monkeys-ish, you know, with the concrete. But. No, I mean, I liked it, but I mean, they were scary as all get out looking, you know, kind of hard to understand, but not too bad.
Well, I think if you spend a moment with their culture, Darren, you'll learn.
Well, I was totally expecting, a reveal of like, it's Kelpians, but just slightly different.
I was totally like, oh, after Vahara.
Sci-fi's taught me anything. It's
maybe there are more changes, and it's and the Kelpians are really the Ba'ul.
And they go through a goth phase, and it's...
So I was pleasantly surprised that
goth
that was
Kelpians
not it.
Is another episode possible title we got here.
Yeah,
but then I found myself wondering, is Armus a Ba'ul?
Yes, I think that's what everybody's been thinking. And I think it could be. I mean, it's basically updated better effects for the same thing.
And all we really know is that he's, like, exiled, right?
Yeah, well, conceptually, he was supposed to be, and Skin of Evil's not my episode I always rewatch, but what little I remember is, like, he's supposed to be literally all the negative emotions and feelings, that's why it's called the Skin of Evil, you know, and so maybe the Ba'ul sort of have some emotional transference, and then they created this sort of blob of anger and just spit it out, and they become happy and gentler.
If anything, we can tell it's like an homage to that character. I mean, that's obvious. It doesn't have to be
which I like to think, like, guys, we should do an homage to a next-gen character. Who's someone that, like, people really... really want to be
dude,
Skin
of Evil, guys.
To.
I would love that episode. We could have Saru being pushed around, and when he's pushed away, he's like, what's his sister's name again? It's
it is Serana.
It's like, Serana, something got me, and then, you know, all the next gen fans are
the Metamucil comes out.
And, if you touch him, I will kill him.
At the end, Saru's like, and I learned a lesson from each of you. So, yeah.
It's I gotta be honest, I don't love the Ba'ul. If you take away the camera angles and the intense music, it's just some guy dripping all over the floor, and it's
so in like normal lighting, it's just this guy covered in paint, and you're like, that's really not scary
at
all.
Hey, that's like half my classic Doctor Who villains there.
I get it. It's just like it's so silly because there's no possible way this is an actual creature that exists, and I know I get it, it's fiction, it's Star Trek, but it's just like you have Saru and Sarana who are sitting in this room, and this thing is just like. It's like just like dripping everywhere. And
were you waiting for someone to take off the mask and be like, "Oh, it's old Mr. McGregor"?
That would be great.
It's Saru's father. That's
I would have gone away with it. Michael Burnham.
So besides like the design, like there's the whole let's look into the history books and the sphere will tell us that. The Ba'ul was the prey species initially and was hunted by the, advanced Kelpians. And it was,
Spike shooters.
And it was really interesting, concept there. Although it's kind of like, oh, and then they invented warp drive to stop it.
And the tables turned.
And the tables turned and they almost wiped out. And then they were they didn't just leave. Because apparently you could do that, but they're like,
with warp,
never again. I'm not saying I disagree with the plot. Like, it makes sense, but...
Well, the numbers that they showed on the screen and the language they used got convoluted, too. Because they started using evolved and unevolved instead of, like, pre- and post-Vahari, which is right. What
I would
it
just
really
said
is.
Woke and not woke.
Right, so shouldn't every young Kelpian be pre-Vahari if it's an individual thing they go through?
Right.
But at some point, there was a zero for unevolved Kelpians, so that didn't make sense. But they also never explained how the Ba'ul avoided extinction.
Right. I mean, look.
They tossed up a bone in the air and after they touched the monolith, and then they knew all that they
Is that where the monolith
go.
Comes in?
Yep.
I knew this would happen.
Yep, 2001.
Did they have, was there like a Ba'ul renaissance?
Look, it used to be about culture
I'm imagining
art and pottery.
I'm imagining the black goo with like the beret hat and the feather sticking out.
Saru, I must protest. I am not a merry man. I mean, sorry. Peru, I must protest.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, it's so weird, this sort of, this thing that they came up with the I'm going to say their names wrong. The
Ba'ul.
Ba'ul.
And the Kelpians.
And the Kelpians. So, okay, so all of a sudden the Kelpians now develop this ability to shoot things out of their head, tiny spikes.
And get super aggressive.
And they're strong.
Okay, like super strong.
That's fine. And I guess the Ba'ul are only smoky and drippy, which is not a great place to be.
Worst dwarves.
Predatory.
Like, if you see that review at a bar, do not go there.
But we're like, the way that they present it, it's like, the Kelpians became so incredibly powerful, there was nothing we could do to stop them until we developed warp drive.
Until we developed this technology of,
I would have been more
magnets.
Interested if, like, they discovered that the Ba'ul were not addictive to this planet. And, like, they came from another planet and then basically enslaved the Kelpians. Like, that would make more sense than they were the prey species and then they flipped the tables and set up the system so that it would never happen again.
The two dominant species, look, y'all are all blue shirts here. I'm the red / gold shirt. But like the two dominant species thing on one planet always sounded me like, could that really happen? I guess.
How could one be developing technologies that the other doesn't?
Yeah.
How are they?
Maybe they're
isolated.
Goo-based technologies.
Maybe
they hid their whole city in that lake.
But if that's what's happening, how can you consider both of them dominant species?
That's the weird. Were you getting Halo vibes from the city coming out of the lake, Daniel? Because I totally was. I mean,
I was actually waiting for the Kelvin Enterprise to come out of there.
I'm still mad about that.
Let's break another Prime directive here. Anyway,
well, look, okay. The Ba'ul wanted to spend all these credits on an interplanetary rail line, and that was just ridiculous. So I'm glad the Red Angel finally came in and shut that down, because they were just wasting. Sorry, it's a California thing.
Well, I guess, and one thing, because, and it's fine. Like, I don't have a problem with how the Bool have been revealed, but I guess, you know, in my mind, when we were been introduced more and more and more to Saru's characteristics, so, you know, the quick running when he was on that one planet, like, I thought literally, and again, you know, it's fine they did this, but like literally Predator Prey, I thought like there'd be a monster that would chase him and eat him, not sort of the sacrificial, you just walk into the circle.
Right. I mean, not much defeats of a predator, him by technology. You know? It's like, oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Well, the thing is,
all the traits they gave him definitely indicated another land animal being.
Yeah. And I don't know if you're aware of this, Philip, but warp drive is actually faster than just running. So okay. It is the case that... I totally agree with you. It's so ridiculous that this a species who can travel betwixt the stars is afraid of these fisher people who just sit there
trying to say it's because they're prey, because they are hardwired to fear the Kelpians.
Well, but not anymore.
But they can't get past that biology.
Well,
I mean,
whatever.
I think that there's a cultural thing too.
They knew that the Kelpians were a threat to them once they were able to shoot spikes, right? So something happened at some point that they figured this out. They figured out that they went through this transition and somehow turned the tables so that the Kelpians beforehand were afraid of them, and they killed them all out before they reached that point.
Much like season 4 of Angel, once Spike shows up, things just sort of.
Although, so every Kelpian on the planet now is a post-Spahari spiker, but I'm assuming then that any newly born Kelpian will be a pre-Vahari.
It's a little.
Although technically we've never established if once you're post-Vahari, if you then conceive a child if they are pre or post. We don't know that.
But then the more I thought about it, and again, look, I'm not. It's a cool Star Trek sci-fi idea. I'm going to go with it. But the concept of like when does Vahari happen? Because it seemed the way Saru explained it two episodes ago, it was, I guess, something the Ba'ul... I mean, you had to read into it, so this is just maybe me reading into it. It was something that the Ba'ul did. Like, they sort of sent off a signal that said, hey, we're ready for you to kill yourself for our pleasure. But, like, when does it happen? Like, is it all the same age? Because,
well,
I mean, Saru's not a young guy.
It indicates that they're ready for culling.
Right.
Yeah, but, like, is it a certain age, or...
Maybe the Ba'ul can tell when they're getting close to it actually triggering, because, I mean, now that we know it's not, oh, we're ready to eat you, it's, no, we're ready to kill you so you aren't a threat.
It just seems, and again, it's a whole new species, it doesn't have to comply by what little I know of science, but it just seems like very late in a life form's developmental cycle, because, I mean, I don't know how long Saru lives.
Well, in the short trek, he says, what if I'm in Vahari the next time the Ba'ul come by? Uh-huh. And his father says, well, then it's just your time. But his father is much older than he is, of course. So it seems to just be whenever it happens for each individual.
So I guess it's just random, or in as much as it seems random.
And I would assume that the Ba'ul would know because they have the pylon in every town.
Yeah.
Right. So they're keeping an eye on what's going on.
The watchful
Vahari alert. Kelpian and kill him.
If only there was some sort of fictional thing where a big eye in the sky looked out. And
it's like a super inefficient way to do this, to control the population, because
1984. Yeah, no, I know.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you're still in a giant city under the water. Even if these people can shoot little spikes out of their head, they're still not coming to get you. You're going to be okay for a few hundred thousand years.
I mean, you're under
the
sea.
They only developed warp technology 21 years ago, okay? They're still working out the kinks.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not at warp 1.5 yet. You know?
Yeah, all right. That's fair. All right.
So anyway, it seemed all interesting. I'm going to fast forward a little bit.
Okay, fine.
But it just, because it seemed like, okay, the scene ended, or the whole episode ended, and it's like, oh, no, wait, we got Tyler here. We were paying him money. All right. Let's do a Tyler scene, guys. I don't know how you feel, Sue. I am obviously on record as being anti-Section 31, so the whole, like, Ash has drunk the Kool-Aid pretty quickly, I have to add, by the way. I can get that he has a different point of view. He's lived a different life. You know, used to be Klingon, all that stuff. So I can see he'd have a different point of view. But he's like Leland Section 31 Kool-Aid about the agenda of the Red Angel. So what'd you all think about sort of that scene and him questioning?
Where you mean where he was like, oh, yeah.
The Red Angel's bad.
Yeah, the Red Angel's bad. Or basically, we should be ready if the Red Angel decides to try to wipe out the Federation. Like, that's basically what he's implying.
I mean, he's not wrong. I feel like I would be arguing those points in that situation. Of like, we don't know that this thing is benevolent. Calm down a second. But, sorry. For me, in general, the jury is still out for me on Section 31. In Discovery, at least. But it makes a lot of sense for Tyler. Because as he says, this is, at this point, this is the only place he can even possibly think of belonging. Right? The Klingons think he's dead. And Starfleet wants nothing to do with him. And he doesn't. He's two people in one. And, you know, Section 31 is the one place, I guess, he doesn't have to pretend to be one or the other. He can just be. But he makes some good points.
Well, I worry that it takes the Island of Misfit Toys and just like, you know how people keep kicking you around? Let's kick them around.
Well, yeah.
And then it sort of gives like the... Look, because when you're in Hammer, everything looks like a nail. So they're just coming at it from, we have to protect the Federation, which means everything is a threat. And no, everything is not a threat. And so that's why I'm more of a Captain Pike. Like, the thing that saved people in the church, saved us right now, saved Michael, saved Spock. Yes, I'm sure it's a threat. But, I mean, to be wary, I'm not saying that. But just sort of Tyler just being full on, you know, we have to look out for the Federation interest. It's all very, you know, it's a short jump to Hydra is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, I think the conceit is that that's their job. Like, that's what that organization exists to do anyways. Because for every Captain Kirk or Captain Janeway you have hopping through time, no widdly diddly, no problems, you have that other guy.
By the way, that was my wife's theory that it's Captain Janeway. But
you have that guy from Voyager who, I can't remember his name now. The guy who was in the 90s who took advantage of the time travel technology.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about.
Future
Ed Begley Jr.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, I could see it, and he's got some good points. Like, it's pretty convenient that if they have time travel and they only show up right before the bad thing's about to happen, well, they probably could pick a better time to prevent these sorts of things. But I mean, like you, Philip, I'm not a fantastic fan of that whole thing being a central part of the show. But if you're gonna have it, this is just the kind of conversations that you're going to have.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess. What about you, Darren? Where do you come on the light versus gray?
I mean,
I'm told one side has cookies.
We still want to know like what the Red Angel is, and as we saw, I mean, we got a really good view of it in this episode from when it came down to help Saru.
Darren, you and I, let's have just a conversation among ourselves. Is this like when Kosh revealed himself? And everyone saw something different.
It could be.
What did you see?
I saw nothing. Don't even know. Don't talk to me about angels and demons. But yeah, we've all kind of shared that we would not be surprised if it was Michael, because this is apparently what the show's all about, and that would not be a surprise. That she ends up being the Red Angel. I don't know if it needs to be that. It could be that, or it could be something else. Hopefully we'll find out in episode 10 called The Red Angel. But
you're really looking forward to that one.
You know, it's just, I don't want it to be the red herring, that's for sure.
No, that's Spock. We'll get to that in a second.
Oh, geez, yes. But no, I mean, with Section 31, like I said before in previous episodes, I like Section 31 a little more in this iteration, and I understand it a little more. But yeah, it's kind of like, okay, make the show about Section 31, or let's just not talk about it. Like, having it as this kind of little corner of this season is a lot for a backdoor pilot, but I guess that's what they're doing.
I don't mean this in a negative way. It's sort of a crutch for the episodes, like, oh, Section 31's here. I'm like, yeah, but you don't need it to tell the story.
Like, I almost expected Tyler to call for help again, know, and just be like, beep, beep, oh, hey, we got the obelisk fleet coming at us, which was an awesome sequence. I mean, they were big and scary and... They obviously had three-dimensional thinking. They were bristled.
I thought it was going to go Tholian for a second, you know, the way they were.
Oh yeah.
That reminds me, we do learn in this episode that the Enterprise has Winamp, because when the when they speak to them over the loudspeaker, we actually get the waveforms and everything. It's pretty cool. So,
oh, Discovery.
You mean the Discovery?
Oh, sorry, Discovery. Oh my God, sorry. Forgive me.
It's okay. You've only been doing a Star Trek podcast for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
So the Discovery is the one where the thing spins. We'll talk about it later, Daniel.
Actually, that reminds me real quick, too, since you brought it up, Philip, because it appears that the Discovery writers have an obsession with things spinning. And my problem is when the giant 50-kilometer radius spaceship city comes out from the water, it's also spinning concentrically. And if it was spinning that quickly, all those people would be dead, pasted against the wall of that giant city because of how fast that thing is spinning. It doesn't make any sense, but I just wanted to know.
What I was surprised by was, okay, so the thing comes out of the water. Check. Good. Where's Saru's village? Oh,
right there.
It's awful right close. There on on the beach of said
Look,
lake.
Darren, they haven't invented swimming yet.
No. So I'm more worried about the tidal wave that's heading towards Saru's village because a giant city just rose up out of... Yeah. I was kind of really surprised that his village wasn't completely wiped out by that city rising up.
Well, I was interested to see they still had Ant-Man in the jail cell there.
Oh, gosh. It's not
the
raft.
Nice. That's a Marvel reference. Good job, Philip. You did nice.
And Owo on the bridge just says there's something coming out of the lake.
The lake.
They're in orbit of a planet, and there's something coming out of the lake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, we assume it's the lake near Saru's village.
Because we would obviously assume that, because why not?
Yeah, but that is a good point, though. It's like, oh, look, there's something in the sky. Jay? Yeah, it's giant... planet, but and we can get a kind of a sense for the size of the Kelpian population, though, because we know that there's around just over 4,000 pylons. So if there's one in every village, and a village is roughly, you know, a certain number of people, then they're not a really big species.
They've culled them well.
Yeah.
That's the sounds of thunder.
I mean,
so
we all kind of knew it was coming here. To this, right? Like, with the stuff that's been going on with Saru, and especially with the short trek, like, I'm like, okay, they're going back to his planet at some point to set them all free. Like, that's going to happen.
I mean,
and then, lo and behold, it happened. Yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised it happened so early, but I don't know. Maybe
we got a Red Angel crisis to solve, Daniel, okay? Let's wrap all these things up.
You know, this in classic Star Trek fashion, this would be a season 4 episode where we go back to the first officer's planet or whatever. You know, but I don't know, maybe.
Oh, that was season 2, the Amok time.
I was surprised to do this so quickly. Especially after we did get the Tilly episode in between, but this was right after the whole thing with the spears and with his ganglia falling out, which, by the way, is hilarious. Every time they hold a fake piece of ganglia up, I have to laugh. It's this little rubber.
I was doing the dialogue for the the people are like looking around like, what happened to my ganglia? Did that happen to you? It happened to me too. Oh, it just came out.
Looks like they're holding those creepy crawlers, but it's just funny. But one thing I wanted to say real quick in closing, or before we close, Pike is still awesome, man. Pike every week is just crushing it, and I just Man, like, even with Saru being totally out there and crazy and, you know, he's emotionally dealing with a lot of stuff.
And sitting in his chair.
Yeah, and sitting in his chair. Pike is just crushing it. He's just a great captain. And every time he's on screen, I'm just like, I love this dude. He's the man. And
ultimatum he's given. Like, he's got some good bridge scenes.
He is one of my people.
Yeah. Oh God, that was so great. How awesome was that?
Yeah. Basically, you know, don't make us your enemies because we will fight over this. It's like, oh man.
Yeah, Pike's the man.
Yeah. No, I if I could say anything about Discovery, it's they have some watchable, memorable captains.
So if Lorca's supposed to be the brash Kirkish captain, and then Pike is the diplomatic but will shoot at you Picardish captain. Does that
sexy
mean
Picard.
Next season we're getting the Sisko captain, and he actually becomes a part of the religion of some planet that they go to? And,
I see Pike closer to Sisko than Picard.
True.
If I think about it. But
I think he
I mean, he's his own, but yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's his own, but if we're doing the spectrum, I feel like he's a little more, in a good way, self-righteous, you know, like a Picard.
So. I think it's episode to episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in New Eden, that was very Kirkian.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this episode, he was more of a Picard. Maybe he strikes the balance. Maybe he's found the new balance.
Oh.
Or maybe some new running shoes.
That's right. Maybe he's like one of those things with Hogwarts where he's like both houses. So he's sort of like, you know, like a...
Oh, so he was...
He's a Gryffindor.
So he's a Kirkcard. I don't know. So anyway, so yeah, Darren, what are your final thoughts about the Sounds of Thunder, what we saw, and potentially where we're going?
Yeah, I thought it was a great episode. I think it was... you know, had some cool twists and turns. Really well done dialogue. I mean, especially on the Michael meeting Saru's sister and Pike's ultimatum. Like, those are scenes that if you don't write them well, they don't work. And they did, and they worked really well. I think, you know, Serana handled being on a spaceship for the first time pretty well, considering, again, I don't know. We've never really interacted much with a species that has seen advanced technology but not really used it. But I guess, you know, we'll roll with that. And
it was a little odd story-wise. I mean, again, I went with it. That's my theme. But, like, the way they filmed it, like, she's on the ship, da-da-da, and then she goes to beam down. She's, like, in the transport room going... Oh my God. I'm like, how'd you get on the ship? That's, what are you seeing this for the first time? I mean, did you just forget what happened 10 minutes ago when you beamed up from your planet? But anyway.
Well, she was starting to have the ethical dilemma that we all have of, is it really me when I beam down?
Right.
And the first time,
you're like, I'm glad.
Yeah. Then the second time, you're like, wait, am I dead? Is this my clone? You know, the Kelpians are very deep. Overall, I really liked it. And I felt it. It summed up this thread, which we know has been coming nicely. And it also, you know, advanced the Red Angel story. Although, Red Angel's getting a little sloppy. It's like, hey, guys, there's totally a thing over here. Oh, as soon as you get here, I'm gone. And now you're here with egg on your face. And now there's a diplomatic incident. So maybe, I don't know. It's
well, I think the weird
but
part,
I'm also
like, going
to show back
this.
Up to help you. Don't worry about it.
That's true.
So why bother calling us in the first place, man? Just fix the problem.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys heard in your episode, but at the end when the Red Angel was like, well, according to Ziggy, and then it just disappeared. So.
Do, 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 do.
He is Archer.
Connection is obvious. He is future guy.
When Michael Burnham stepped into the Quantum Leap Accelerator.
It's why we never heard of her. There's this sort of timey, spacey thing that wipes out her memory, but she's allowed to go on affecting changes anyway.
But it was cool. And again, I really liked the scene, though, with Michael and Serana, like his two sisters. You know, that was a really cool scene. And, you know, and also I'm glad that she stayed because she's right. Like, they got a lot to do in rebuilding their society. Or not rebuilding it, but, like, evolving it.
No, this is early days. This won't get invented for another 5 or 6 years in Starfleet, but where the cleanup ship would come up after the Enterprise. So I guess.
Although I did have one last thought. So, you know, they're talking about the Barul, and like their fear basically is that if you have a whole planet full of, you know, evolved Kelpians, that they're going to basically just break the balance. And I kind of took that not just in the balance of wiping out the Ba'ul, but also, like, you know, we don't really know a lot about evolved Kelpians. Like, are they going to still be a kind of, like, fishing, kind of tranquil little village, like, group? Or are they going to start, like, conquering the planet and killing other Kelpians?
I want some Ba'ul soup now.
Well, again, not even with the Ba'ul. Like, taking them out of the equation, I would, like, I almost have a fear that the Kelpians are going to start, like, fighting each other.
Yeah, is Saru going to continue to get more aggressive and more unpredictable?
Exactly.
No, I mean, they're going to go from fishermen to artists, sculptors. So you're going to see Saru doing a lot of painting, you know, clay possibly.
Is Saru's village going to be super important because it takes over the spinny city and has a tactical advantage against the others?
It's called Spin City, and it ran for several seasons.
That's all. That's all I had to say.
So, Daniel, what are your feelings about the Circle of Life?
The Circle of Life? Wait a minute. That's I rag on Discovery's writers, and to me, they're sloppy with the big picture stuff, like this sort of the Ba'ul versus the Kelpians, and it's clearly not well thought out. It's just sort of what works, and we'll just throw it at the screen. But what they're really good at is the smaller character stuff, and like that's what really gets me motivated to keep watching all this stuff. You know, we talked about the Pike stuff, and that's such an amazing scene where he's like, he is our people. And then like two scenes later, you have that same thing where he's like, okay, well, we're going to go to war with you if we have to. And then a scene we didn't talk about was between Saru and Culber in the beginning of the episode. Mm. And Saru walks over and he's like, dude, this could be, I know it's like scary right now, but this could be really important and this could make you a better person. And obviously that sort of storyline is going to continue on. But that scene when he like reaches over and he like puts his hand on his shoulder, that stuff is like awesome and really on point. There's really good character stuff. The world building is not the best, but I love Saru. So this episode was good for me. Not great, but good. And but it was also kind of a bit in the middle in a lot of ways. But I guess we'll see what happens when we keep moving on and where these threads go. Where does Section 31 go? And are we going to see Serana again? I hope we do, because she seems really cool. That sort of stuff. But I enjoyed it, even though there's a lot of ginormous plot holes.
That is great praise from Daniel. I'll just point out, this is the writing team. I forget the women's names, but this is the writing team for this episode. Are going to be the showrunners for Section 31. So just FYI
interesting
on that.
Okay.
I'll do my final thoughts because you are the guest. You get to have the last word here. Like I said, the more I watched it, the more I just sort of thought like, oh, you know what? This is TOS. This kind of a story.
Yeah.
So I was giving a lot of allowances, you know, not in a bad way, because I mean, I like TOS. And so I just sort of like, how do you deal with that sort of that stereotypical TOS land on the planet, change everything, blow up their gods and call it a day? You know, this was obviously a little more, you know, detailed than that. So I did enjoy it. I really enjoyed it for the season. I'm not sort of keeping a running tally like a lot of people, but like I liked episode one, like episode two, skip, skip, skip. And I like this one. And so, of course, I mean, this has a great heart to it. You know, it's a planet story. It's a cultural story. You know, we can discuss about whether decisions were right or wrong or indifferent, but it told a good story about that thing. Of course, that's my, you know, old school TNG episodic nature may be coming out that, it, you know, but that's just me. You know, but that's why I tend to like episodes like this. It's a little self-contained, even though it obviously tries to fit into the larger arc. So I thoroughly enjoyed it, though. It does make me wonder, is Culber now more afraid because his beard was sort of like the reversed ganglia? And then once the beard falls off, he's now afraid of everything. So, it's just a thought. So Sue, what are your final Saru thoughts about where we are and where we're going?
I think I'm kind of like a combination of you and Daniel, right? Because, yeah, there are huge holes in world building. Sometimes there are huge holes in the science. Sometimes magic mushrooms. But, like, that, to me, is not the point of Star Trek and has never been the point of Star Trek. We are here for the stories. We're here for the messages. We're here for the characters, the themes, and what they learn. And that's what I think that Discovery is doing really well. They're doing it sometimes differently than other Star Treks have. But in a lot of ways, some of the episodes, especially in season two, do feel very TOS. And I don't know. It just, it stops me and it makes me go, what are people complaining about? Right? The people who just want to rag on Discovery. And I think they're looking for things to be mad about.
I mean, we do have a few episodes you can listen to, Sue.
Yeah, no, I know, but like to completely dismiss something and say it's not enough this, it's too much this, and it's happening in other fandoms all the time as well. But just the point for me of any Star Trek is the stuff that you talk about 5 years on, right? We, the four of us, might sit around 5 years from now and laugh about, you know, the numbers on the screen in one scene, but your average fan isn't. Your average fan is going to talk about how one creature suppressed another and how they're going to work together to rebuild their world. And that's what the Star Trek message is of this episode. You know, it's whether Culber is still really Culber now that he's been put back together from the mycelial network. It's all of these other questions. And to me, that's what they're doing that right. And that's what's important. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. No.
And so I know you were talking about episode titles, Darren. I was been Googling. I do not have an episode title for the next one. So if you have it, please let me know.
Oh, we do.
Oh, we do. We do.
Yes. So the next episode is called Light and Shadows.
Light and Shadows. Well, that's really clear. So Light and Shadows will be next week. We are teased with Daniel. I don't know how to break this to you. Spock might be in an episode. Might be in an episode.
You know, they've said it before. They've showed shots before. We've yet to see Spock. I don't know.
We're moving beyond Shuttle. Shuttle's like first base. So we're going to go to the second base.
So now we get mumbly Spock, who doesn't have any lines, but he mumbles.
Look, Spock's going through his Benny phase where he's writing on the walls.
Oh, God.
But we actually got other titles as well. We got a new crop. So next we have Light and Shadows, then If Memory Serves, Project Daedalus, The Red Angel, and Perpetual Infinity. So one of those has got to be the time travel episode, right?
Okay.
So a lot to look forward to. So Darren, if folks want to talk to you about your favorite episode title in English, where can they reach you?
Never the Latin ones. They can find me on Twitter, Twitch, or Instagram under username Dr. Sci-Fi, DRSCSSSO. Lost it there. DRSCIFI. There we go.
Don't worry, the Red Angel will come and fix it for you.
Red Angel, right. You're my only hope.
So, Daniel, if folks want to take a bet into your lottery about what episode Spock will finally speak a line, where can they find
a
you?
A real line, mind you, because he'll be mumbly next. And you could probably discern a line. They can find me on Twitter, @1UpDan. That's the number one, not the word.
And Sue, if folks want to talk to you about the science of mushrooms, where can they reach you?
You can find me personally on Twitter @SPALTOR, that's Spaltor. You can also find me co-hosting Women at Warp @womenatwarp.com.
And if folks want to talk to me about the Pike vs. Lorca fanfic I've written, when I say verse, it means something else. They can find me on Twitter @NCPublicServant. Well, guys, until next week in a next episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 2, I'm Philip Gilfus.
I'm Darren Moser.
I'm Daniel Prue.
I'm Sue Kissenweather.
Stranded here on City Alpha 3.